Did you know your actual age may not be the same as your biological age? That's right. It's not just about your birth date. Your body could be older or younger than you think. That's where True Diagnostic comes in. With their True Age test, you can discover your true biological age, plus get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. And the best part? It's all done from the comfort of your own home. No prescriptions, no lab visits, just a simple test sent right to your door. I just ordered my True Age test, and I'm excited to see what it reveals about my health. I've had ups and downs over the years with my health, and I've embraced the process to stay open-minded and continue to learn about how it can shape its course. I'm curious to see these results because in my mind, I often feel very young and even childish. But there are days my body has its own opinions on the matter. By tracking your biological age, you can actually see how the changes you make, whether that's exercise, diet, or sleep, affect your health over time. It's about taking actionable steps to improve your well-being. Ready to find out your biological age? Right now, my listeners can get 20% off their entire order at truediagnostic.com by using code MINDFUL at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, TRUDIAGNOSTIC.com. Just use code MINDFUL to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off that 20% discount. Discover your true age today. Delicious meat, nutritious. Crack into a good source of protein with tasty, healthy, Wonderful Pistachios. Wonderful Pistachios is a complete protein, providing all 9 essential amino acids. In fact, each 1-ounce serving of Wonderful Pistachios contains 6 grams of protein. Pistachios have got to be the tastiest nut. Pistachios are delicious, they pack a nutritional punch, and are oddly fun to eat. It's like a little dopamine drop every time you hear that shell crack open. Personally, I like them roasted and salted, but you can find your favorite shell or no-shell variety at WonderfulPistachios.com. Whether you're running between meetings or dropping off the kids, Wonderful Pistachios are the snack that works as hard as you do. Check out WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more about this healthy, tasty snack.
There's two different things that are going on. So we're looking at gut immune, and then we're also looking at gut brain. So we'll talk about gut brain first, and then we'll talk about the immune response because they're kind of two separate issues. So when we're talking, remember those things that I said about digestion? We are, those things need to happen to digest your food. So we have a gut brain connection. So we have a vagus nerve, which goes from the gut to the brain. Now we think of our brain as just like, okay, this is our nervous system, but we actually have different nervous systems. So you have your central nervous system, which is the brain, you know, when we're thinking of our brain, we have on our enteric nervous system, which sits in your gut, and there's millions or trillions of neurons there. And then we have our autonomic nervous system. And this is working on things like this is fight or flight or rest and digest. And it's more of the autopilot. So to actually digest and absorb well, we need to be in a parasympathetic nervous system.
Meg Mill, thank you for joining me on the Mindful Movement podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me today.
I really appreciate you reaching out. I never get tired of speaking to people in the functional medicine world. I feel like they generally ask the better questions and wind up with better answers because of it. You were a doctor in pharmacy, you mentioned, and then you kind of left that field and moved into the functional medicine field?
Yes. And I sort of had a two-pronged reason that I did this. So, you know, I was a clinical pharmacist. I did a residency after I graduated and worked in hospitals in clinical pharmacy. And I started to see, you know, I was really always about prevention and what we can do. But when you're really practicing, you see all these people put on so many medications. And then we're managing medications for issues with other medications. And it just, you know, I know the protocols, I know why it's happening, but people were really just feeling that space of surviving rather than thriving. And we're not really getting the education that they needed to really reverse some of the symptoms. It's like, okay, we'll put another med on. And like, you're fine until you need another med. And so I was seeing that professionally. And then I also started having some personal health issues. So I was having a lot of GI issues. I was having anxiety. I was having insomnia, like some reactions. I felt like I was very limited in what I could eat. And so I started jumping around from, we moved a good bit at that time. And I would jump around to like, okay, maybe I'll see a new gastroenterologist and I'll get some answers. And I finally figure out what's going on. And then again, I would get, you're fine. You look great. I was very young. You're healthy. And I'm like, I do not feel fine. I feel terrible and no one will give me any answers. So I'm just stuck in this place. So after years of that and cycles, I realized like, okay, I need to do my own research and take this into my own hands. And that's when I started research. I'm like a researcher by nature. So I started researching and, you know, really dug into the microbiome, into the gut-brain connection, to all these things, was able to heal myself. So I went back and left and got certified in functional medicine. And now I have a virtual practice where I work with people all over the world. And it's really wonderful because we're seeing transformations. You can really be left in this place where like, okay, I have to live with this. I mean, migraines are another good example. I mean, severe migraines, even daily, and people can live migraine free. They just will stop having them. But they're never given that option because it's just like, okay, take the medicine to band-aid it and not really get to why you're having it.
Gotcha. There's a lot of things I want to touch on there. So, and you also don't just practice, you host the Little Bit Healthier podcast.
Yes.
Which I was, just to prepare for this, I was listening to a little bit of your stuff and it's fantastic. And
thank you.
Very recent episode, the gentleman was talking about like glyphosate, how it could be like sprayed afterwards on organic food and we think we're dodging it. It was like infuriating to hear.
It is like, infuriating,
it's,
right?
It's like this is just such a relentless uphill battle trying to avoid toxins in our environment or food supply. And so, you know, having a better understanding of these things, like you mentioned, like gut-brain connections to so that we have better toolkits and better awareness of how to navigate forward is so important. So you mentioned that when you learn more about the microbiome in the gut, you healed your own issues. Can you touch a little bit more on what that looked like and what you found and what strategies helped you individually?
Yeah. And I think that this is a really important thing to talk about because we need to be able to see exactly what's going on in your microbiome to be able to heal it. I think I have heard someone say before, which I like the analogy. I mean, if you're not really getting a stool test and you're not seeing what's in your microbiome, you're kind of steering this ship with iceberg underneath and you can crash into the iceberg because you're not seeing what's underneath the surface. And so we have a lot of people out there talking about the microbiome now, which is great. We have a lot of information about probiotics, fermented foods, bone broth, things that are helping, but we actually need to see what microbes are out of balance. So we can have specific microbes that cause specific things. So we can, you know, we know that there are specific microbes that are mast cell activating and histamine producing. Well, if you have those specific microbes and you eat fermented foods, you take probiotics and you drink bone broth, you're actually going to feel worse because those are triggering you. Those are, you know, promoting more histamine and your microbes already are. So we have to look at it based on what's actually going on. So I think doing a stool test is a really valuable resource to be able to say, okay, what do I have going on in my microbiome? Do I have overgrowth? Do I have, you know, this opportunistic overgrowth? Do I have H. pylori? Do I have yeast? Do I have parasites? Do I have, you know, E. coli or C. diff or what's going on? And then beyond that, you have to look at your digestive functions. So we need to make sure that anything that we're eating, we actually digest and absorb. If you're not digesting and absorbing your food, you're not getting the nutrients. You can eat perfectly. You can have a beautiful diet. And if you have poor digestive function, then you're not getting the nutrients you need. So we need to look at all of that. We need to say, do you digest fats? Do you digest, you know, proteins and carbohydrates? What's actually going on there? Do you have enough stomach acid?
Can I stop you there? How do you determine if somebody is having issues digesting a particular macronutrient like fat or carbohydrates?
So we look at specific markers. So for example, in a stool test, we'll look at a steatocrit level. And so that will say, okay, if there's high levels of steatocrit in your stool, it's likely that you're not digesting fats very well. So
what is that? What is steatocrit?
Steatocrit's measuring the fat in the stool. So we're saying, okay, in the stool, we're seeing steatocrit, we're measuring fat. If you have a lot of fat, you know, in your stool, then we're not digesting it as well. We look at elastase, which is another marker to measure your pancreatic enzymes. So when you eat, and we can get into more like detail on this, but when you eat, we can, let's go there now. So when you eat, your body needs to release, you know, we release stomach acid to digest. Well, first we release enzymes in your mouth. And so we need to release that to actually break down the food in your mouth. And then it goes into your stomach. And then we need to release stomach acid to actually break down food in your stomach and make it in this chum that goes into your small intestines. Then we need to have your gallbladder release bile. So bile is what helps break down your fats. Whenever you have your gallbladder removed, you are often not told that you need to take something maybe like ox bile because you don't have that sac that's holding your bile and releasing it in this like perfect amount to be able to digest your food. So, you know, if you have a gallbladder, you'd have to think of, okay, well, now I don't have that organ anymore. What do I need to do to replace it? So that's helping us digest fats. And then we also have our pancreas, which is releasing enzymes in order to be able to digest your food and break down. So when these functions aren't happening well, then you can, when you, your food can actually enter the small intestines and, you know, colon and different places in bigger particles than we want them to, because they're not being broken down well. And then that gives your, these opportunistic microbes a place to feed on more. So they're bigger particles and there's more food to feed on and grow and, you know, create this, what we call dysbiosis. So the dysbiosis occurs when we have overgrowth of bacteria that shouldn't be there. And then we really haven't touched yet, but on there's often we see a decrease in the good bacteria that we need for a lot of our immune function and in really like short chain fatty acids, which help us with energy production and all of these things. So we're really looking at balance and creating this balanced microbiome. But in sometimes we can do that with diet, depending on what's going on. If you're eating, you know, we want to increase fiber, we want to increase colors of the rainbow, vegetables, things that are going to feed our microbes the way we want them to. But a lot of times what I see is, particularly when people get to a certain point, we actually have to look at what's going on and then we have to do specific targeted things to bring everything back into balance.
Do you find that those stool tests are really accurate as far as the microbes that are showing up and directing more successful strategies to improve it?
I do. I mean, I see like huge health transformations. And it's, you know, keep in mind, it's a snapshot. So we can see a test that comes back that shows a certain picture, and then we can work on those things. And then we can potentially do another stool test that's 4 months later, and maybe a parasite shows up and it hadn't shown up before. And now we're seeing it because that, you know, it's a different sample, but we, and sometimes you need to work through layers. But I do see whenever I'm using the stool tests and really getting the specific information that I can target it the right way. And like, I see health transformations that are not even GI related. I mean, that's where I think it is so powerful, is we can have skin issues. I mean, I had someone that was like calling me. I do these consultation, a discovery call before I work with people. And she had missed her discovery call with me to kind of see how I just make sure we're a good fit, that I can help you. And she had missed her call and she was like, please still work with me. And she showed me a picture of her body completely covered from head to toe with hives. She's like, I need you. And I was like, oh, yes, you do. We need to get that. But within weeks or maybe a month, you know, it takes a little bit of time to go, the hives went away. So it's these like dramatic, we see dramatic changes even in skin. We can see hormone changes.
Can I ask, Meg, because I had history of that, head to toe hives, eczema. What was the thing that helped that recent caller, like or patient, address that?
Yeah. So generally we're seeing, often I see layers. I don't have like her specific test, you know, in my mind of exactly, but what we're seeing in general is we're looking at what are the layers there that need to be fixed in your gut. And so generally I'm seeing a combination of things like H. pylori. We'll see candida. Yeast is huge with skin. So yeast is huge with skin. I see yeast huge with brain fog. That's another thing. You can just have that foggy mind where you're like tired. You can't think well. So when we heal candida, we see a big change, but that's another one. And then often when we're seeing more skin-related specific things. We're seeing more of those. I mentioned those specific like histamine-producing microbes. So those can be things like Morganella, Klebsiella, Citrobacter. We're seeing like more specific microbes that we're looking at, and we need to target them, you know, and so we need to look at the layers and what we need to do. And order's important too. So it's how you approach it and what you're doing in a systematic order to kind of get everything back in balance. But really, once we start to do that, we just see these dramatic changes.
Yeah, I want to get into some of those details, those strategies. But first, I guess maybe you could touch on this whole idea of like how those affect the more systemic things. Like I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that wouldn't see that connection of, you know, what's going on in your gut and your skin and your brain and how they're connected. You mentioned in your journey, you were dealing with gut issues, anxiety, insomnia, things that probably many people would say aren't necessarily related, but my guess is you feel like they were, you know, whatever, yeah. Addressed one, addressed them all. That's yeah. The impression I get. And why does that happen? What's the connection there? Can you?
There's two different things that are going on. So we're looking at gut immune, and then we're also looking at gut brain. So we'll talk about gut brain first, and then we'll talk about the immune response because they're kind of two separate issues. So when we're talking, remember those things that I said about digestion? We are, those things need to happen to digest your food. So we have a gut-brain connection. So we have a vagus nerve, which goes from the gut to the brain. Now, we think of our brain as just like, okay, this is our nervous system, but we actually have different nervous systems. So you have your central nervous system, which is the brain, you know, when we're thinking of our brain, we have our enteric nervous system, which sits in your gut, and there's millions or trillions of neurons there. And then we have our autonomic nervous system. And this is working on things like this is fight or flight or rest and digest. And it's more of the autopilot. So to actually digest and absorb well, we need to be in a parasympathetic nervous system. Many of us are living in this fight or flight. So when you're in fight or flight, when you're in the sympathetic nervous system, your body's being told, like, run from the lion. You know, you have a lion chasing you. Don't digest. Don't relax. Go. And so the things that need to happen in order to digest our food, like this, you know, your parasympathetic nervous system is saying, release the stomach acid, release the enzymes, release the bile, do the things that we need to digest. Your sympathetic nervous system is saying, like, run from the lion. So a lot of people in our current society are living a lot of the time in that sympathetic nervous system. We're just taught like, go, 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 we have to do this. Make it a little bit more complicated. Stress isn't just emotional. It's not just our to-do list. There also are biological stressors. So if you are exposed to mold, if you maybe had COVID and had a huge viral load, if you've had, you know, a tick-borne illness, if you've been exposed to a lot of chemicals, if you have these underlying gut infections, so many things start to happen. Your body is seeing, okay, I'm stressed because I have these invaders coming into me. I have these things. And so there's also like a biological stressor component. So sometimes we're in this fight or flight also from biological stressors. So we work a lot while we're working on the microbes and all of that specifically on bringing your body back into the parasympathetic nervous system. So how do you regulate yourself no matter what's going on? And so I work with a lot of people, you know, I actually work with nervous system work along with the gut health work with pretty much everyone I work with, because if we're, you know, doing all of the other things and we're not able to regulate ourselves, then we're living in this fight or flight, and it's actually telling our body, okay, there can be microbiome changes. There's all sorts of changes that are happening because you're in this stress point. So we're working on bringing we work on somatic work. We work on breath work. We work on vagal nerve toning, limbic system work to bring our body back to that calm place. So, think of gut-brain connection. There's messages going up and messages going down, and they're cross-talking all of the time. So
Do you feel like we the also, nervous system work is like the priority to set the stage first for everything else?
I do. I think you have to be doing it. I mean, I think really if you're, and I think no one, and people don't want to hear that. You know, they want the test, they want the supplements, they want those kind of things. And they don't necessarily want to hear like, okay, I want you to take a break every 3 hours and sit and just in your chair for 2 minutes and just teach your body to relax. The thing is you can use your breath. So we have a free tool, everyone has it, that you can actually use your breath to help regulate your nervous system. So even just sitting, grounding, doing some deep breathing can really bring your body back into that place. We can also do that before we eat. So just taking a few deep grounding breaths, but when you're sitting down to eat, take a minute before that. And that can also help your body relax when you're actually eating your food.
And those strategies could also be done prior to diving into a lot of testing. I myself have not had the success you speak of regarding like the stool tests, and they're not fun to do. And the idea of having to do another one to follow up, like, I often wonder, I've heard doctors get really mixed results on that stuff. I've even heard somebody say they sent the same sample to two labs and got different results. So, like,
you have to get one you trust for sure.
Yeah, they might be helpful, but do they necessarily, like, can you make that progress without some of the testing? And some of the things that work the best, it seems, are the free things, like learn how to regulate your nervous system, because that same meal might be appreciated by a nervous system that's ready for it, or it might be feared by a nervous system and attacked by a nervous system that is not ready for it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that you need to be doing these things for sure while you're, you know, doing the other things. You know, personally, just because I've run all of these tests and I've worked with so many people, I do see the value and the life-changing aspect when we can really target. But I always am working on the basics and saying, okay, we need to be getting more fiber in your diet. We need to be taking out processed foods. We need to be like limiting sugar and, you know, prioritizing prebiotics and foods that are feeding the gut microbiome. But we also need to be doing the nervous system work and bring your body back in that parasympathetic so that we can prioritize.
You mentioned a lot of people will show with an overgrowth of bacteria. Do you ever find that increasing those fibrous foods are like backfire on those patients?
Yes. You have to be really careful with fiber because I just had someone new come yesterday that was saying she was out there reading, like, just increase fiber. And she just started increasing her fiber so much and it just made everything so much worse. And that can happen. We do need more fiber, most of us, than the standard American diet gets. But you do want to increase fiber slowly because you also need your body to adjust to that fiber increase. So if you just start to increase your fiber, just like if you start to take a ton of probiotics, it's a lot of times going to backfire.
Yeah, I'm really confused over the fiber thing because I understand theoretically how it could be beneficial. And I know people that it does clearly seem to benefit. And also, I know many people that do better without it. And I mean, now you have these people on the carnivore diet, which I don't necessarily think is a great long-term strategy, but it's zero fiber. And a lot of them are doing very well. And trying to reconcile all these different outcomes it's challenging because it seems like for some people, fiber is really beneficial. And for some people, it's not. And maybe it's just not for right now. And maybe that's because there's too much bacteria and you don't want to be feeding it.
I think that you're bringing up a good point, and this is something I talk about a lot. Diet in general is very unique to individuals. So I think to go out and say everyone needs to eat this way can backfire for a lot of people because we're individual people, and what can be good for someone else may not be good for you. And like exactly what you're saying, I see people that I'm saying, okay, that is good, but not for you right now, because where you are right now, that's not going to make you feel better. But we need to get this in place. And then we're working to get there. So I think it's really, I would say the takeaway is listen to your body. And so what makes you feel better? Like, what does increasing your fiber, I'd say very slowly, do you see improvements in your bowel movements? Do you see improvements in GI symptoms? If not, though, you're right. Those are all, there can be high FODMAP foods in there. There can be foods that you're high histamine foods in there. Depending on what's going on, you may not feel better on these foods right now. And don't push it if you're not, because that might not be what you need right now until you get some of the other things in place.
Sometimes I feel over the course of like my bumpy healing journey, I guess, is that when I've had a positive effect from fiber, it's been a function of getting some of the bile that's recirculating. When I have like a high toxic load, that I'm just like recirculating crap by recirculating bile, and fiber's giving it something to bind and draw out and maybe encourage my body to create some fresh bile and kind of clean the soap dispenser or something. Does that make any sense?
You know, we also need to make sure we're having regular bowel movements, because we need to actually be eliminating the toxins. And so I think that's another thing that people, just a lot of people have had constipation issues for a long time and feel like that's normal. Like, oh, I only go to the bathroom every 3 to 4 days or every other day or skip days, and feel like that's okay just because that's their norm. But we really need to make sure that you're eliminating. So especially when you're, if you're pushing any toxins out or doing anything, you have to be able to eliminate before we do any sort of work there.
As a functional medicine practitioner and with the background in pharmacology, I guess, where does like thyroid interventions come into play in your routine? Do you find ever that because where like the thyroid and metabolism in general sits in the like stream of things, that you can get some downstream positive outcomes by addressing things more with like, you know, bioidentical hormone stuff?
Yeah. So I think that when you think about sluggish thyroid, sluggish everything. So when we have low thyroid function, we have slower motility. So like we're saying, you'll often see constipation and you'll see issues because the motility is slower. So we have to optimize thyroid function, you know, to optimize motility. So I think it's just a crosstalk of everything, you know, where more, and that's the difference, one of the differences in functional versus conventional medicine. So conventional medicine is bucketed into like specialties. So we're going to look at this system and this system only, you know, you go to a different, then they send you to a different doctor because that, and you can see why, because if you're having heart surgery, you want it to be the heart surgeon that knows everything about that organ. But we really, our bodies are communicating in every level. And so as we're talking about the gut brain, the hormones are connected too. So we need to talk inflammation that can be, you know, we can go back and forth with thyroid. So we're saying, okay, sluggish thyroid equals sluggish everything that affects GI motility. It affects the microbiome, all of these things. But then we're also looking, let's say, at a Hashimoto's dynamic. So we were talking about the gut and the immune system. Once you start to get leaky gut, once you start to get tears in that gut barrier, you start to leak particles from the gut lining. I'm kind of simplifying it, but that go into your bloodstream, causing an immune response to say, okay, wait, these are invaders. I'm not expecting you to be here. And then if you have a genetic propensity, you can start creating antibodies to specific organs. So that's where we see in Hashimoto's, those antibodies are attacking your thyroid hormones. So, or your thyroid. So it's affecting your thyroid hormones. So we need to actually heal the gut lining a lot of times to work on that Hashimoto's dynamic in order to bring your body back into balance.
Gotcha.
I'm shocked at how many people I see that have been on thyroid medication for years and have never even been tested for Hashimoto's antibodies. So we're not like often people aren't even looking into
change the strategy? Like if somebody comes in and they have gut issues and let's say they're on medication and they haven't tested for Hashimoto's, like would the goal still be to heal the gut? Like would it change direction?
So I think, you know, when we're looking at it, yes and no. So it depends on how far along that you are in the disease process when we're talking about the Hashimoto's. So if we can see the antibodies early on before there's actual severe damage to the thyroid, you can potentially not have to take the medication. So when we start to see the antibodies elevated, we can do the healing of the gut and lower, see a lowering of the antibodies. Now, if you're in that disease process a long time and there's already a lot of damage, we can still slow the antibodies down, but we also, you still might need to be on the medications, you know, because you've already had damage and we need to support you with thyroid hormone. But I think it's worth evaluating and getting a full thyroid panel when you're in the beginning of this process to see, okay, what is the dynamic that's actually causing the thyroid dysfunction? Because otherwise it's more of a glandular dysfunction.
Putting aside the Hashimoto's or autoimmune component, this is something I've been, I guess, trying to figure out and thinking a lot about over the last year or so, this relationship between the thyroid function and metabolism and the health of the gut, really. And like, regardless of what came first, because like you said, the like a sluggish thyroid will slow down the whole migratory motor complex. It'll slow down all the gut function, essentially. But then also a stress in the gut, whether it might be too much of the wrong bugs or whatever, will be a stress that negatively affects thyroid function. So regardless of like which one caused which, like chicken or the egg thing, is like how to compare the value of trying to heal the gut first to see if it affects metabolism and the thyroid function positively, or trying to directly upregulate that thyroid through hormones to get that gut functioning better so that the natural processes that improve the, you know, microbiome makeup and all those downstream things improve. Like, have you tinkered with trying those from different angles to see, like, is there more value in trying to, if you, like, let's say you do a stool test and you see a certain bug that has a history of not being a good bug to have. Partly, we don't, you know, might not be sure that that's the bug creating the symptom, even though it's there. You're seeing that that's what the body's excreting. We don't know if it's in the small intestine wreaking havoc or it's not, and it's just in the large intestine and maybe it's not wreaking havoc. It's hard to tell from what's in the toilet. But let's say you see something there and you, you know, you want to try to see if helping that will, you know, help the whole systemic system. Like, I mean, do you ever just try to go upstream to the thyroid and see if the body, if you increase the metabolic rate, let's say, and increase all that gut function, will the inner wisdom of our body's healing process be able to move forward? Or do you feel like you have to kind of, I don't want to say micromanage, but do you have to be more, do your interventions need to spend more time on the gut directly so that the thyroid doesn't have a stress and it could rise up on its own?
Well, I guess I do multi-pronged approaches. I would work on both at the same time. I wouldn't say like, oh, wait, we won't touch anything for the thyroid until we heal, you know, work on all the gut. But I, you know, I would say we're working on upregulating thyroid function and bringing your gut back into balance. So I don't know that I can like say which one I would feel like is better, because I would probably work on them both simultaneously.
Gotcha. Can I ask you what you're looking for on the thyroid side when you're, if you see someone that has a sluggish situation and maybe they're having overgrowth and things are bogged down and maybe they are doing a lot of like opening of detox pathways and things in theory, you know, they have room to get rid of stuff and but things are just not you know, fully functioning yet, like, and you want to see how do I interact with the thyroid? What are you looking for? I've heard, we've had a couple people on the podcast with kind of different opinions of like what framework that they're approaching thyroid markers with. What's your take on that?
So you mean like what thyroid testing are we doing?
What testing, what biomarkers? I've heard a lot of people talk about testing body temperature and pulse and I've heard somebody recently on the podcast said that doesn't really relate well, and I don't know how to make sense of it all.
I know.
Like I personally am tinkering with this. So I have a history of, you know, a lot of this is for selfish reasons, and you know, hopefully the audience coming along for a ride could pick up a useful tip. But I mean, I have a history of having these massive skin flares head to toe, and okay. it was really bad, and it's got much better, and I've healed from it like multiple times. It's come back, and recently it's like showed its face a little bit, just a little bit.
Okay.
But I'm like, there's always a fear, like, oh, I can't handle this raging back. Like, I can't emotionally take another round of this. And I seem to be managing it mostly.
Okay.
But I'm like, I'm always questioning, like, what am I missing? Like, am I taking the wrong approach? Should I be going farther upstream? But then when I delve into that, because I haven't really thinking about the thyroid until like the last year or two, and I tried to approach it first mostly with diet, and it's done a lot of good things, but it's also done some things that didn't seem to be really helpful. And then I've been tinkering with thyroid medications, but I get such different opinions on how to look at how to approach the biomarkers, how to approach the medications. So I'm trying to get, like, what's your take on it? How do you approach?
Yeah, so I think I would say interesting with when I think of skin. So let's just go back. Let's take a step back. So
sure.
When you're having the skin, can you tell me a little bit more about the skin issues?
Well, you know, I almost feel like I'm being greedy because it's like, you know, it's 5% of what it was back in the day. Uh-huh. But I mean, I got Lyme in June of 17. And it was a real stressful time, emotionally okay. stressful time. Now I know that's not a coincidence.
Yes.
And, you know, eventually I had a functional doc say, I think you had mold exposure. Check. There was a bunch of mold in the house. I went through like years of doing all kinds of like cleanse things, whether they're okay. candida or parasite and lots of detox related things, you know, whether they're, you know, addressing constipation, whether they're, you know, sauna use, and made a ton of progress.
Okay.
And it took a while at first. Like the first round of it was the worst and was just completely failed by medical. You know, all they had is one tool. Here's a steroid.
Yes.
And the topical steroid was like a real problem getting off. It was a very, you could tell that the body created like a withdrawal to topical steroids. So it was really, even though I felt better, like getting off the steroid was such a
just masking the inflammation
process. And but basically, you know, I got to the point where I was maybe 99% better. And I tried a lot of things. So I don't know exactly what are the things that had the most impact. And I tried a lot of things that didn't work. But because I was always trying so many things, it was hard to identify what's the exact thing that didn't work. I definitely realized along the way I had an oxalate issue. And okay. And that had a component. It was like I had three different rashes at the same time. It was almost like each style of rash was its own like
issue.
Mm-hmm. And so like now when I get it, it's only one style and it's much, okay. much lower. But I've basically fully healed from it like three times.
Okay. And then it comes back.
Yeah. So
I'm wondering if you have any mold, you know, if you're around sometimes when you have that hot, because when I think
the house tested
again,
cleaned up, like, I don't think it's that anymore. Okay. It doesn't mean I don't have it in me. And that's why you mentioned candida was a common thing you work with.
Candida, you know, too.
And I was, so that might be playing some role, and it might be like some foods that just trigger that, but some foods
even
that seem to trigger
foods.
It, even mm-hmm. moldy
like
foods,
even if you're eating moldy foods. So when you're having issues with mold, because I'm thinking when you're talking about thyroid, the skin to me goes more along the, not that you can't, generally with thyroid we're seeing more like the dry skin, things like that, but when I'm hearing the rashes, that you know,
I've had the dry skin too.
Okay, too. Yeah, so then
I've had a lot of things that I didn't know were signs of low thyroid. Until I learned those are all signs of low thyroid. So that's why I've been like intervening with it. And I've had a lot of like progress from that.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. So that's a component. You know, it's looking at all the different things, but looking at potentially doing, if you're flaring, okay, you know, where doing a mycotoxin test, repeating some of those tests and seeing like, okay, is there anything that's coming up? Do you find that you're more stressed when you get a flare too?
There have been times where that has happened, but like I feel like I've managed my stress a lot better as of the last few years. And dietary change definitely helped with that. I was like in a low carb sphere for a long time, not realizing that that, I think, in itself was a stress to my system. And so that was like a really eye-opening, like pivotal point of my journey, which I've also heard a lot of people go through. Like people go through, like they get, you know, healthy and they go whole foods and paleo and then they try keto and then low carb or and then lower carb and even lower carb and then and it all goes well until it doesn't.
Yes,
like they feel great until it doesn't, and then they start introducing carbs again, and like I didn't realize that 100 grams of carbs a day was still low carb. 150 grams was still considered low carb if you talk to a dietitian, and that was like an eye-opening thing to me. So I made a lot of progress with that, but some of the things that seem to help, like some of the carbohydrates that seem to help me feel better in so many ways, seems to be not great for some other things. And I've been trying to, I guess, just dial in the nuance and find the balance for me. But it seems like thyroid plays a role. And I just don't, like, I hear all these different opinions of how to approach it, like whether it's T4, T3, combination, what biomarkers actually matter. Like I hear a lot of doctors say nothing means that you can't learn anything without reverse T3 and knowing that. Or some people say you don't need any of that. Just take your temperature.
It keeps, so, you know, reverse T3 is going to compete at the cell receptor site. So if you're having a really high reverse T3, you know, ultimately, and I know you've said you've had many experts on here. So ultimately, we need to make sure that your thyroid hormone gets in your cell. So, and I think that that's where a lot of the confusion comes in, you know, just with that standard TSH where it's just the feedback mechanism. It's not really telling you if that the T3 is getting in the cell. So we need to look at the, you know, I usually do the whole thyroid panel. So I would do the TSH, the T4, the free T4, the free T3, the reverse T3, and do the antibodies. And just to have a whole picture, you know, so you can see, okay, what is your picture? Now, there, like you're saying, there is controversy on how well that free T3 marker actually measures what's going on. And, you know, there's a lot of different opinions there. And I agree that you can talk to different experts and hear different things. But, you know, I also do see people feel better when it's optimized. So, you know, we really look at those numbers and then we would approach it basically from, okay, do you have a low issue? Do you have an issue producing your thyroid hormone, or do you have an issue converting from T4 to T3? Or do you have an issue with, like you're saying, with stress because you have high reverse T3 and, you know, it's competing at the cell receptor site? Do we have high antibodies? And so we're looking kind of, and then, I mean, personally, I, with everything, take into what are you feeling? I mean, I think that that's exactly what you're saying with diet. That's exactly, like, who is this person in front of you and what are they experiencing and what are their top symptoms? What's bothering them? Do they have symptoms that relate? Are they, you know, is this not the primary focus? Maybe we need to get to other layers first. It all depends on that unique person and what's their goal and what's their biggest symptom. So I think it's very, I like to individualize it. I say, I agree with you with diet. Like we said, not every diet's right for every person at the right, you know, you have to look at what you feel and how you feel on the food. I mean, I have talked to experts that are brilliant people that are saying like vegan is the only way to go because of all these reasons that they can cite research. And then you have another expert saying that they believe in carnivore and carnivore is making people feel better. And, you know, they can argue their points, but who are you and what do you feel? I think.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point. And what works for somebody is likely going to be different than for somebody else. So can I ask another question about that thyroid stuff? So the idea of the reverse T3 is that if that's high, that's basically stopping T3 from getting in a cell and doing its thing. So even if you have free T3 that looks normal on a blood marker, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're utilizing that if you have reverse T3 that's too high.
Yes. So yes, correct. The reverse T3 is competing at the cell receptor site. So we have to get the T3 into the cells. So it actually can compete. And so that's why we're saying, okay, if the reverse T3 is high, is there a competition at that receptor cell to actually get the thyroid within the cells? And so we see that happen from things like chronic stress, illness, trauma, very low calorie diets, fasting can sometimes be some of
the any stress, basically, in any form.
Yep.
So if that was the case, is that a reason to, if you're going to intervene with thyroid, to use T3 and make sure there's no T4 that you can convert to reverse T3? Or is that just meaningless unless you address the underlying stress?
I think you need to, I would focus on addressing the underlying stress. We just want the, you know, physiologically the stress to be brought down.
Okay, I'll move on. So to, when you look at the common things that people are dealing with in their gut that are like sending all these, you know, stress signals north through the vagus nerve, whatever, and just disrupting their life, quality life. Like, where does candida fit in that? Is that, do you think, like the most common culprit, being that so many like dwellings have, like everybody's, so many people have been exposed along the way of just being on this side of the dirt for so long?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, well, I mean, I see it vary. I guess, again, I can't say it's the most common. I mean, I see a lot of people that have candida. Candida is tricky because we're going to look at that in a multi-pronged approach there too. We have to kill off the candida. And then we also have to starve. You really should eat low sugar diet if you're, when you're trying to kill candida, because candida feeds on sugar. So if you're doing herbs and you're, you know, biofilm busters and all the things, and you're actually eating a lot of sugar, you're still feeding the candida. So it's one that, you know, is a little bit more complicated because you do have to look at the diet specifically. I mean, you do it in anything, but very specifically with candida. Gotcha. So I think that that's something that people can struggle with coming back a lot, but I wouldn't say necessarily from like hundreds of stool tests, you know, maybe thousands stool tests at this point that I've done, it is like, oh, it's candida, you know, a candida is the biggest culprit. Gotcha. It really varies person to person.
So this is another thing that I have trouble in my head with, that I don't know how to like reconcile some of this stuff. So candida eats sugar, but is there a form of sugar that it like thrives more on? Because like our body's making sugar. Like, is the sugar we make from, let's say you don't eat sugar, but your body, or any carbohydrates, and your body's going to make, you know, 100, 150 grams of glucose a day through gluconeogenesis or whatever, so that your brain can eat or run. Like, does candida have access to that? Or is the idea that if you, because it's generally housed in the GI tract, the sugar your body makes doesn't really get to it, and only the sugar you're eating? And if so, like the different sugars that are generally found in our food, like whether it's sucrose or fructose or lactose, like are there ones that it prefers?
Yeah. So it prefers simple sugars. So glucose, fructose, sucrose, you know, those kind of sugars, like you're saying, you can't eat no sugar. So we're just looking for a low sugar diet. Gotcha. So we have, you know, your body, you have to have sugar to, you're never going to not be able to have any sugar. And like you're saying, your body's going to make glucose. But we just want to bring down the excess sugar so that there's not, you know, this overload of sugar from that you're actually ingesting, that your blood sugar's, you know, sky high. We want to make sure that we're lowering your sugar so that there's just not as much excess for that candida to feed on. And I do find, I mean, I don't know, in my opinion, and like in my experience, really, when we have a candida infection, we really also do need to do some treatment to bring that candida down, to really see it go away generally, depending on how overgrown it is.
I want to ask you what some of those treatments are, Meg, that you feel like have been the most successful for you. One other question on this topic, though. Sorry, I'm getting I have a lot of selfish questions today. It is my podcast, so I can do that. So when I hear about SIBO, you know, they talk about, well, you're supposed to have all this bacteria in your large intestine, but then it grows too much and you get it in your small intestine due to various reasons, and then you get an issue and things like low FODMAP diet help or whatever. With candida, is it in the same place? Because when I think, like, is candida supposed to be none in our small intestine when we have an issue? That's where it is? Because if I eat, when I think of, when you say a simple sugar, I feel like a simple sugar is quicker to digest. It's like easier for us to digest. Like we get it faster. We would, in theory, have it higher up in the small intestine, which to me feels like an advantage because you're not as likely to feed things farther down the GI tract with it because you get it first. Whereas maybe something that's more complex is going to spend more time and it's going to get farther down. Do we know when people have an overgrowth of candida where it generally is in the, like on the map of the GI?
The thing is, candida is not just in your GI tract. So you're not, you know, we're measuring it in a stool test in your colon because that's where, like what you said, we're measuring what bacteria in your colon. So that's what measurement we're getting, but it is systemic. So you can get a candida positive test from urine, from blood. Like it's not just in the GI tract. So it's really looking at, you know, I don't know that we can target it like in a specific place. It's just we're using antimicrobials to treat it. So we're going to use things like often we can use garlic, we can use oregano oil, we can use caprylic acid, we can use combinations of things in order to really try to treat the candida.
Are those some of your go-tos, the garlic, caprylic acid, oregano? Is that what you said?
Usually I'll do a combination of things.
You feel like it just works better if you're like hammering it from different angles? I've heard some people that say do that. I've heard some people say try one and then like switch up before it like
we
adapts
do
or whatever. And if you do a switch up plan, how often do you like how long you do you think somebody should try one thing before switching?
It kind of again depends on the person, the levels, all of that. But you know, I would give it at least 4 weeks of something before switching. You know, some of these things take a while to work.
And you feel like just reducing the sugar intake during that time will generally move the needle for most people?
I do. Yeah, I think that it helps. It's, you know, it kind of like, again, we're looking at these multi-prong approaches, but I think that it helps. We're saying, okay, let's, you know, I'm results focused. So I'm always, you know, people are paying me to come and get them results. So
right.
We're trying to get results. So what
better.
Can we do to get the most results the fastest? There's a lot of different ways we can do it, but we're, you know, if you can say, okay, you know what, for this time, I'm going to bring down the sugar. We're going to, you know, do supplement regimens. Then we're just seeing results faster.
Yeah. These are some weird puzzles I know for people to figure out. You mentioned, you alluded to migraines earlier in the conversation, and I've never really experienced that, but I've definitely known people that suffer with migraines, and it seems to be a weird thing trying to figure out what, you know, why they get them and finding reasonable solutions for that. Do you find that there's a lot of gut-related things that are behind migraines?
Yeah, so, you know, gut-related things, we're seeing hormones, immune system responses, food sensitivities. Migraines are something that we can really make a huge difference with. I've had people who have had chronic migraines every day for years and, you know, migraine-free. So I think it really is something that they're missing in the conventional space. I mean, just giving medications to treat the migraine symptoms, or even those, you know, prophylactic treatments often have a lot of side effects and don't really control migraines. So we're saying, okay, why are you getting the migraine? And what are all the reasons that we need, like, what are all the things we need to do to put in place to reduce them? And once we do that, it's really life-changing.
So what's actually going on in the migraine? Is that just like an inflammatory response that's just in the brain?
Yeah, and you have, it can be dilation and constriction of blood vessels. And so, you know, you're getting the inflammatory response, you're getting the dilation and constriction of the blood vessels. Usually the migraine is your body signaling something else is going on. So like, why are you getting the migraine? What is your body needing to signal, you know? And when we're really finding that out, that's when we see the difference. There can also be nutrient depletions. I made a list one time of like 50 different things that can be going on at the same time. But it's like a puzzle. Once we put that puzzle together, and they're different for everyone, but really you can do it. So anyone that has migraines out there know, like, you don't have to live with them. There are things we can do for sure.
What's the hormone connection to migraines?
Generally, I mean, there's different hormone connections depending on when you have your migraines, but a lot of them we're seeing an estrogen dominance. And it also has to do with the way you metabolize your estrogen. So it's not just if you do a hormone test and you see high estrogen, you may see low estrogen, We're looking at a lot of different ratios there. And so we need to look at the way you metabolize estrogen and its relation to progesterone.
Can you elaborate that a little bit more? So generally you're saying if there's a hormone relationship to migraines, people will generally have more estrogen than progesterone. Is that both for women and men?
This is generally more specific to women and what hormonal migraine. So a lot of women will get a migraine the week before their period. And then that specific time, that's generally an estrogen dominant picture.
Is that when I should know this because I live with women and have grown up living with them, but is that when estrogen is naturally higher in the cycle, or is that?
Yeah, so estrogen and progesterone are both. So in the luteal phase, you have an increase of both estrogen and progesterone. But sometimes the progesterone, especially as we go through perimenopause, we're not getting as much progesterone. That often goes down first. And so you'll have higher levels of estrogen than progesterone. So you become estrogen dominant at that time. So they should both be rising and falling, but we'll see a bigger rise of estrogen than we are of progesterone, creating an estrogen dominance.
And then how do you approach something like that as a functional medicine practitioner?
Yeah, so we just have to create, again, it's balance. We have to create, we look at pathways, we look at, how the body's processing their hormones, and we create balance in order to get the hormones balanced with it. Hormones are all about balance in the body, so we just need to balance them out. And then we start to see such improvement.
So is that like a combination of working on how you're metabolizing it, the estrogen, and then how you're making it, or how do you address the balance of hormones?
Yeah, so we have to look at estrogen pathways and in how we create the balance within the path. We could honestly do a whole nother podcast. We could do a whole nother podcast because it's pretty complicated. We can, you're looking at all the hormone pathways and how you're creating, you're creating balance and how you're actually metabolizing the hormones and what pathway you want it to go down. And once we change some of those things and we have things specifically we can do to get there, depending on your unique hormone balance, then we get the balance. Now, the thing is, I would say one thing I caution here is there's a lot of products out there, a lot of people talking about everyone should take this for hormones. I see a lot of people out there taking these products. And if you don't know what your own unique hormone picture looks like, you could be doing more harm than good. So with hormones, I say it is a good idea to test.
Gotcha.
Just to see what your balance is right now or imbalance is, and do something specifically for you rather than just taking a hormone supplement, because that's just looking at one picture, not your picture.
Yeah, wise advice, I'm sure. Hormones, I'm sure, is a really delicate matter to be tinkering with that stuff. A Little Bit Healthier Podcast. I love that name, by the way.
Thank you.
It's great. It makes me think, what was that book? Atomic Habits, where the guy's just get 1% better a week kind of thing. It's just get a little bit healthier and let those things compound, let those changes compound. So what's your goal with that podcast?
Yeah, so exactly what you're saying. I want everyone to know that there's things they can do every day to be a little bit healthier. And I think sometimes people shy away from it because they think, I have to make these huge changes. Like we brought up carnivore or vegan or these big things. And you don't have to do that. You actually can do something every day to be a little bit healthier. So the point of the podcast is to show you, okay, let's talk about different topics and what can you do today? Put one thing in your life today to be healthier. And if you just create small buildable habits, you're going to feel better. And we can go deep, we can go complex, like some of the things we're talking about, but you also have so much more power than you realize and able to do things every day.
For sure. Well, then I have to ask you, Meg, you have, formal medical training as a pharmacist. You obviously work with patients and you've also gone through your own thing, it sounds like. So what do you do to be a little bit healthier each day? What are some of your, staples that you rely on personally?
I would say things that just going for the most basic things. I would say I try to bring myself back into that parasympathetic nervous system regularly. So even in between, that's what I'm telling people It doesn't have to take an hour. You don't have to do an hour of meditation. You can sit in your desk in between appointments and just sit there, ground yourself, and do some deep breathing. So we're working on nervous system regulation. I also try to eat healthy and a variety. I try to eat a variety of foods. You know, eating a simple thing I can share with you is, you know, look, you eat a rainbow, you know, try to eat colors. That's just a very simple thing that you can try to add. And then getting movement. How do you move? Do you create, you know, a lot of us sit at a desk all day. What can you do to move your body, to exercise? Everyone has a different ability to move, maybe based on your health condition, but everyone can do something. So creating movement and then making sure you're prioritizing sleep too. I think that's a big thing. If you're not, sometimes people are, you know, when we're talking about like, oh, I'm exhausted, I can't do this. Well, how do you sleep and how do you prioritize sleep? And that's an important thing, you know, really for resting our immune system, all a whole variety of things.
Gotcha. Yeah, the sleep thing's weird. Like I've noticed in my own case, when I have issues flaring up that seem to be gut related, it affects the sleep in a way where I'm like waking up in the middle of the night kind of thing, hard to get back. What is that? Is that just the body's like stress response and you get a cortisol spike and that's waking you up?
That could be, you know, it could be a cortisol spike in the night because of the stress that you're going through physiologically.
Gotcha. It's something that I've heard a lot of other people talk about too, that they deal with. So it seems to be pretty common, and it's tough because everybody says sleep is important for your health. So it's like, you're trying to get healthier, but you need the sleep.
I know.
Then whatever's bothering you is interrupting your sleep. And it's like, that's not a great cycle to get stuck into.
Yes, I agree.
So for people that want to learn more, other than your podcast, A Little Bit Healthier, Meg, how else should people connect with you or find out about more?
So my website is megmill.com. It's just megmill.com. I have a lot of free resources over there. There's a free guide section. So, you know, on gut health, hormones, a whole bunch of different things that you can check out and look at. And then I'm over on Instagram at Dr. Meg Mill. It's just DrMegMill. So,
and you're working with patients like one-on-one through telemedicine style? Or?
Yes, I do. Yes. Okay. And I also have a group program called the Women's Wellness Collective. So it's really focusing on all of these health, particularly women's health issues, and what can we do to get the things that kind of are the biggest struggles for women in their health journey back into balance. And we have monthly meetings, different topics, things like that. So that's another, that's megmill.com/collective if you want to hear more information about that.
And is everything you do online? Do you do any in-person stuff? Or
I do have, you know, a little bit of in-person, but mostly I'm online now.
Okay. Well, Meg, I really appreciate you guys reaching out, and I appreciate you taking the time and enduring my selfish questions today. it's just things that have been on my mind. So I was glad. I was like, oh, I have somebody to bounce some ideas off of. And I do know some people dealing with some migraine stuff, so I'm going to send them to your resources and see if they could help and maybe reach out to you. So I appreciate you taking the time. And for the listeners out there, always grateful for your listening. Hopefully you got some value out of this. And if, you know, I recommend you check out Meg's podcast. Does a tremendous job at it. So it's clearly a great resource out there. And I hope everyone has a great day.
Thank you.